Welcome to the FTC Privacy and AI Enforcement Trends, a fireside chat with the FTC's former Consumer Protection Director. I'm Christina Tucson. I'm the chair of the Beverly Hills Bar Association's Privacy and Cybersecurity Law Section, and I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, Sam Levine. Sam previously served as a director of the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection, where he oversaw enforcement, rulemaking, and policy work across a wide range of areas, including privacy, data security, marketing, financial services, digital advertising, consumer reporting, algorithmic decision-making, small business financing, just to name a few. Before his appointment as director, he served as an attorney advisor to Commissioner Rohit Chopra and as staff attorney in the Midwest Regional Office. Prior to joining the FTC, Mr. Levine worked for the Illinois Attorney General, where he prosecuted predatory for-profit colleges and participated in rulemaking and other policy initiatives to promote affordability and accountability in higher education. And now let's get started. So, Sam, we're really happy to have you here with us. You and I work together at the FTC, so I know some of your roles there, obviously, but let's talk about your background and roles of the FTC and how those changed over time.
Sure. Well, first, it's really wonderful to be here. I actually got my start in consumer protection during the financial crisis. I was in law school at the time. I got involved in a legal clinic where I was representing people in foreclosure. That made me really passionate about using consumer protection tools to advance economic justice. And it also made me really angry, frankly, at what little the government was doing, both to prevent the mortgage meltdown, help homeowners through that mortgage meltdown, and I know Californians were very hard hit, and hold accountable the executives that I think caused the mortgage meltdown. So that gave me put a real fire in me around consumer protection. I took that fire to the Illinois AG, where, as you said in the intro, I really focused on for-profit colleges. I got to meet Rohit Chopra at that point, who was the student loan ombudsman. I then wanted to work with the Federal Consumer Protection Agency, the FTC. So I started in the Chicago office there. I moved over in 2018 to advise Rohit Chopra, who was one of the Democratic appointees on the commission during the first Trump administration. Until about 2 months ago, the FTC was a bipartisan commission. Commissioner Chopra sat on the commission until 2021. And then in 2021, when Lina Khan, who had been a fellow in our office just a couple of years before, became chair, she named me head of the Bureau of Consumer Protection. And for those who don't know, the FTC is more or less comprised of three bureaus: Bureau of Economics, which does economic analysis across the agency's work; Bureau of Competition, which enforces the competition laws in conjunction with the Department of Justice; and the Bureau of Consumer Protection, which enforces consumer protection laws, the FTC Act, of course, which prohibits unfair deceptive practices, but also a host of other laws: Fair Credit Reporting Act, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, many other laws. And BCP, in addition to doing enforcement both in federal court and its in-house court, also does rulemaking, which I know is something we're going to talk about. So, really broad portfolio at BCP. It's a team. It's about 440 people. That sounds really big. That's actually a very small group responsible for rooting out unfair deceptive practices throughout just about the entire American economy. So I really like to say the FTC punches above its weight. It's a small and mighty team,
Absolutely. Well,
as you know well.
I can't agree with you more. Having worked there, really amazing attorneys doing some really, really important work. Definitely small but mighty is certainly my description. So, when you were director, what were some of the priorities in terms of the types of cases the FTC was bringing in the privacy and AI space as you sort of, shape that as a director, kind of looking into what priorities you were looking at when you were there?
Well, when I became director in 2021, AI was not the hot topic that it is today. And one of the things I'm proud of is I think we were a little ahead of the curve there. In the summer of, I think it was the summer of 2022, we issued a major report on the uses of AI around how AI can and cannot be used to challenge certain consumer abuses like fake reviews and bias and others. And when the generative AI hit, in, what was that, late 2022, I think was chat when ChatGPT rolled out, we were able to move very quickly to start bringing a whole host of cases. We started by laying out really comprehensive and award-winning business guidance and how our laws apply to the use of AI. And then we moved pretty quickly to bring in cases. So we brought cases around unsubstantiated claims about the impact of AI, AI decision-making systems that result in errors and discrimination. All sorts of cases around companies that were used promising people could get rich using AI tools. We shut those companies down. And we also did some rulemaking, which I can talk about, to try to get at AI fraud, which is a major concern and a growing concern. On
Absolutely.
the
Go ahead.
on the privacy side, and again, these are related, obviously, but on the privacy side, very early in my tenure, I said that the goal of the privacy enforcement work of the FTC would be to move away from notice and choice, which is this notion probably most of your listeners know. It's basically the privacy regime we've lived under for decades, except in California, where people are essentially expected to protect their own privacy online by reading lengthy terms of service and privacy policies and deciding whether or not they want to use the service. It's a total fiction. It's been a major failure. Companies can decide at will whether they want to change these policies. It's completely unrealistic for consumers to expect themselves. So what I to protect themselves. So what I said early on is this regime has been a failure. We have to be honest that this has been a failure, and we have to use other tools. And the biggest tool that I advocated using at the beginning, and I think we delivered on this over the last 4 years, was unfairness. Historically, the FTC focused its privacy enforcement on deception. Are companies misleading people about how their data is being used? That's certainly something we continued to do under my tenure and under Chair Khan's tenure. But we shifted a lot to bring in a lot more unfairness actions, where we said whether your privacy practices were disclosed or not, they were substantively harmful. They put people at risk of substantial injury. That's the test for unfairness under the FTC Act. And we brought a whole series of cases using our unfairness authority to not just require that data sharing or data use be better disclosed, but to actually restrict the ways in which companies can use people's data, especially their sensitive health data, their location data, browsing data, kids' data, et cetera. So the big theme of my tenure was moving toward substantive protections, data minimization, as opposed to notice and choice. And of course, in the background, as we were advancing that agenda, we saw a whole lot of states. California led with this early on, but we saw a lot of states over the last few years pass their own privacy laws, most of them grounded in data minimization principles. So I really saw the FTC as trying to lead a whole of government, not just federal, but also state government effort to move away from notice and choice and toward real safeguards for people's privacy and personal information.
Well, Sam, that's a really important point because I know one of the challenges in working in this space is, somebody makes a deceptive claim and they're told that's a deceptive claim, and then they can go forward and simply change the claim in the small terms and conditions, and then the consumer is still no better off, right? The deceptive practice may continue. So I think it's really important that distinction you made and really moving towards the unfairness analysis and being able to sort of really make a change in that space. And that's just such a really important shift and really great that the FTC moved in that direction, because I think we all are familiar with the very large terms and conditions that maybe nobody besides you and me, and well, sometimes my children I force to read, but I think
I
most
don't read them. I
well,
don't have time.
I read them for my own purposes, but
Yeah,
anyway,
right.
fair enough. Well, let's talk a little bit about kind of the evolution of the FTC's privacy and AI space. You talked a bit about that before. I know an FTC report has talked about since 1999, there have been 97 privacy cases and 169 telemarketing sales rule and CAN-SPAM cases, really a lot of activity over the years there. But and of course, affecting millions of consumers, getting really significant restitution and changing practices, which is great. And you talked a little bit about how it's changed in recent years, but Can you give a more of a sense as to how much it shifted in terms of privacy and AI really being a more of a focus than maybe it was, even though there were a number of cases over the past years?
Yeah, I think the history here is quite interesting. I'll try not to drone on too long about it, but when the internet emerged, when Al Gore invented it, when it emerged and personal computers in the 90s, the FTC was very ahead of the curve. There were a whole series of reports, I'm sure, I know you know this, Christina, that the FTC issued in those days, sounding the alarm around kids' privacy. It's what led to passage of COPPA, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, around websites that were tracking people ac across the web, around what information consumers might be turning over to scammers, thinking that they're turning over to legitimate companies. And I think the reason this work fell to the FTC is because there was no comprehensive privacy law then, and there's no comprehensive privacy law now. There's no privacy enforcer then, nor is there today. So sort of by default, it fell to the FTC. And now I should say there is some history for why the FTC became the de facto chief privacy enforcer. We had long, I still say we, I don't speak for the FTC, never did, I certainly don't now. We had long enforced the Fair Credit Reporting Act, going back to when it was passed in 19, I think it was 1970. We had long enforced Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which mostly was a deregulatory bill, but also provided certain privacy protections for consumers of financial services. And of course, the Unfair Deceptive Practices Authority is quite broad and can be adapted to addressing privacy harms. So that's how the FTC essentially became the de facto privacy regulator. And in the 90s, as I said, the agency was really prescient in sounding the alarm around practices. And the hope then that the FTC expressed was that companies would take self-regulation seriously. And would develop their own frameworks to protect people's privacy. That did not work. Year after year, the FTC expressed frustration that companies were not doing so. And in 2000, this is still under the Clinton administration, the commission called on Congress to pass comprehensive privacy legislation. That was 25 years ago. I think they were really ahead of their time on that. However, there was an election in th that November. The administration changed hands the following year, and when the new FTC administration came in 2001, one of the first things they did is they said, "We're changing our mind. Congress should not pass privacy legislation. We do think that self-regulation can work, and we're really going to focus on offline harms as opposed to online harms. We're going to focus on do not call violations, unwanted telemarketing, identity theft." That was a pretty narrow focus. Over time, I think the FTC definitely broadened its enforcement. It started bringing unfairness cases to challenge reckless data security practices. That happened, I think the first case was in 2005. It started bringing deception cases during that same period around companies that misled people about their privacy policy. And over the years to come, you saw the FTC, it waxed and waned depending on the administration, but certainly, and you know this, Christina, during the Obama administration, you saw the FTC very active in trying to get Congress to pass privacy legislation and to bring in privacy cases of its own. I think the big shift that we tried to effectuate under Chair Kahn over the last 4 years was moving beyond deception. As I said, the FTC had used unfairness to challenge data security practices. The FTC hadn't really used unfairness to challenge privacy practices that maybe were disclosed, but that still harmed consumers. So the big change, as I alluded to earlier, that we tried to make over the last 4 years, was recognizing that in a world where everything we do is often mediated through digital services, whether it's connecting with our friends, keeping track of our fitness, keeping track of our health, we can't rely on consumers just read ever more policies. We need some basic bright line guardrails on how our information can be used. If I'm going to GoodRx to get a discount on a prescription. It shouldn't be the case that GoodRx can then sell information on, or share information on what prescriptions I'm using with Facebook. And the fact that that might be disclosed somewhere does not make it okay. So that was the position that we moved toward over the last 4 years. And I know we're going to talk about this. We brought a whole series of cases making clear that the FTC's enforcement, the FTC's unfairness prohibition actually restricts the kind of sharing of sensitive data that companies too often engage in without regard to how it could harm consumers.
Yeah, that's great. That's a really, really important background in terms of how things have progressed there. So let's switch. We've talked about the privacy space a bit, and let's switch to the AI space, which, as we've discussed, the FTC was sort of did some early analysis on. But let's talk about some of the cases that the FTC has done in the AI space, and maybe we can start with talking about the Rite Aid AI bias case, and kind of give the listeners a sense as to what that case was about, and maybe some lessons learned from that.
Rite Aid was a really important case. So I don't recall whether Rite Aid is a big chain in California. Maybe you can tell me.
It is a bankruptcy.
Yes, that's right. But Rite Aid, of course, is a chain of retail pharmacies. They deployed an AI facial recognition system to try to deter shoplifting. But the system had serious, serious flaws. Serious, serious accuracy issues. And Rite Aid's employees, as the FTC alleged in its complaint, were very poorly trained on how to use the system. Both how to upload photos of suspicious persons and how to use the system's recommendations to identify suspicious persons who were in stores. And this particularly impacted people of color and women, for whom the error rate was much higher. And what we allege in the complaint is that it got so bad that there were young mothers and their daughters wrongfully detained in Rite Aid stores, accused of shoplifting because they were falsely matched with someone else in some other state who had actually been accused, who had actually either been engaged in shoplifting or had been tagged as engaging in shoplifting. So you see here kind of the real world impact. You know, people talk about AI like it's an abstraction. This is when the rubber meets the road. This is when this AI facial recognition system was deployed so recklessly and the system was so sloppy and error prone that it resulted in real, very tangible harm for people in these stores who were innocent, but they were wrongfully detained and humiliated. So the FTC alleged the use of this system without taking adequate safeguards was unfair under the FTC Act. And we actually prohibited Rite Aid from deploying AI facial recognition for 5 years and required that if Rite Aid does deploy any kind of biometric surveillance system in its stores, it needs to do detailed and regular auditing to make sure that the system is accurate, to make sure that the system does not result in bias. Now, I think this was a really important case for a number of reasons. First, I think we stopped a really egregious harm that especially women and people of color who were going into these stores were facing. Second, I think we sent a really strong signal to the market that companies can't just purchase AI systems and install them. They really need to be careful and to ensure that these systems are accurate, to ensure that employees are trained in how to properly use them, to ensure that they're regularly being audited for accuracy and bias. And I think it was also important in terms of the development of FTC law. You know, if we had brought this case, I don't know that we would have brought this case a decade ago. But if we had, it might have been, for example, a deception theory. Maybe Rite Aid should have told people that they were using these systems. But that is not the theory we brought in the case. What we said was substantively unfair for Rite Aid to do what Rite Aid did. And that's how we were able to get the strong remedy that resulted. So I think, you know, Rite Aid was an important case in its own right. I think it also sent, based on what I've certainly heard from many defense lawyers, a really important signal to other market participants. And by the way, I've heard from many compliance lawyers that Rite Aid was helpful in their counseling their clients that they need to be really careful when they deploy these technologies. Again, I should have said at the top, I am not anti-AI in the least. I use AI tools for all sorts of things. I think it offers a lot of promise. But what I believe fundamentally is that the laws that govern every other corner of the market, there's no AI exemption. And as with the use of any tool, companies that use AI tools need to ensure it's not harming people, need to ensure it's not discriminating against people, need to ensure they're not making false claims about the abilities of these tools. So I really just see this as applying the law to a new technology, but just something the FTC has been doing for its whole existence.
Right. In the same way you wouldn't have an employee that you weren't monitoring who was making statements or doing things you weren't approved of. The AI models need to really be monitored in that way.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the AI space, talking about some other cases, can you talk about the Ring case and kind of what the circumstances were of that case and maybe lessons learned is it there as well?
Well, Ring was a home security camera. Amazon purchased Ring at some point. I don't remember when. And what we alleged, among other things, was that Ring employees were spying on people. We're spying on people in their homes using this technology, thanks to really sloppy back-end protocols within the company. We required Ring. I can't remember how much they had to pay. I want to say it was tens of millions of dollars. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on that. This is why sometimes AI is better than humans. And we brought that case in conjunction with another case against Amazon Alexa. And I think it's important to view these cases in tandem. We announced them the same day because in that case, what we alleged is that Amazon was retaining children's voices indefinitely, and which violated Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and using those voices to train their AI model. And the message that we wanted to get out through that case, and that we reinforced in our recent updates to the COPPA rule, is that COPPA prohibits retaining people's information indefinitely, and there's no exception to that because you're training or because you intend to train AI models. So in that case, again, was brought with the Department of Justice. They paid a civil penalty of tens of millions of dollars. But, and I think the most important message there was that COPPA's prohibition on indefinite retention applies. AI does not create an exception.
Great. Yeah, that's a really important point. It's not just how you're collecting the data, it's what you do with it once you have it. There are lots of rules around not over collecting and what you do after you have it. And I think that's really important. And you were right, it was 5.8 million in the Ring case. So it was millions of dollars.
And then I think Alexa was 20 something. I was thinking of them together. I thought it added up to $30 million. But again, go ask ChatGPT; it could tell you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So no, that's great. So, I mean, those are really important cases, and obviously the FTC is moving quickly in a space that I think a lot of companies and individuals are trying to sort of catch up on. What advice do you have for companies who are looking to incorporate AI into their businesses? We talked a little bit about some sort of lessons learned here, but any more general advice as people sort of are looking at the newest trends and thinking they can sort of move their business along more quickly and improve things. What should they be considering as they do that evaluation?
I mean, so there's no shortage of ways that AI can be useful, and there's no shortage, I'm sorry to say, of companies to get in trouble through the use of AI. So maybe I'll focus on two in particular, in addition to those I already mentioned. I'll say three. First, I understand, we want to see a vibrant competitive market for developing AI tools. But that can lead to a temptation to overstate the ability of these tools. And the FTC has brought a whole series of cases. And by the way, some of those cases are continuing in this administration, which I think is notable, around claims companies are making about their AI tools. So we brought a case against a firm that claimed their facial recognition was bias-free. It wasn't, we alleged that was deceptive. We brought a case against a company called Do Not Pay. I believe the California Bar Association also had a run-in with them, which was an AI lawyer. I don't have any problem. Some of the lawyers in the crowd might try to throw tomatoes at me, but I don't have any problem with people consulting AI around possible legal problems. But you need to talk to a human too. And what Do Not Pay was saying was that you don't need a lawyer as real as the FTC alleged in its complaint. This can be your AI lawyer. They were overstating the ability of their technology to actually act as an attorney. We alleged that was deceptive. And we made clear, by the way, that we're not against using AI. We're against making false claims about AI. So if you're selling an AI tool, or if you're using an AI tool and you want to represent how you're using it to consumers, make sure your claims are backed up. I'll give one more example in that space of a case we brought with the LA District Attorney, actually, against a company called NGL. It was an anonymous messaging app. I won't get into all of the rather gory allegations, but they claimed that they had an AI, I think it was content moderation system, to keep kids and teens safe on the platform. We alleged, and we had good reason to allege, that that claim was not substantiated. You're seeing a lot of, New Jersey just brought a case. You're seeing a lot of AI safety claims now. Those need to be backed up too. Two other quick pieces of advice I would give. One, companies are increasingly turning, I've seen this in my personal life, to AI chatbots to provide customer service. My advice there is you're responsible for what your chatbot spits out. I have heard about examples of chatbots making deals with consumers that maybe the company did not like. My view, other enforcers might take a different view, but my view is that you are clearly responsible for, this chatbot is essentially acting as your agent. You are responsible for what that chatbot represents to consumers. And on the flip side, if your chatbot is misrepresented, if I ask a chatbot, are you going to retain this chat? When you delete data, do you sell my data? Do you share my data? And it lies to you. I think the clearly right answer under consumer protection law is that the company responsible for that chatbot is responsible for that. If those are false claims, the company's on the hook. So companies should really be very, again, it's not about being anti-AI. It's about making sure you realize that if you're going to get rid of the human, just as you're going to be responsible for what your human customer service agent says to a consumer, you're going to be responsible for an AI customer service agent.
Right.
Last point I would make, because I know it's a hot issue in Sacramento and it's a hot issue in state capitals all over the country. Surveillance pricing. People also know it as personalized pricing. There are a lot of, at this point, it's mostly consultancies out there offering to help companies, instead of sort of having one price for one product, have one price for one person, to personalize prices for Christina, for Sam, based on my location, my demographics, my purchase history, my browsing history, you name it, all the data that's out there on all of us can be used to set an individualized price. And these companies are promising, these consultancies are promising that this can be profit maximizing for sellers. There are bills in a number of states to prohibit surveillance pricing altogether. We're happy to talk about that. But the fact that those bills exist does not mean that it's lawful in all instances today. I think there are significant legal risks around using these perhaps third-party pricing tools. You run the risk of discriminating against people. You run the risk of price gouging. Let's say the system during a natural disaster jacks up prices in different parts of the country that are being affected. And you run the risk of really pissing off your customers. Now, that's not illegal, but that is something that should be in your. And I should add one more risk. We've seen a lot of enforcement, both in the private bar and by enforcers, and many states and municipalities have laws, so-called fake discount laws. Companies that are claiming this is 20% off, but it's not really 20% off. Maybe a product is always 20% off, or it's 20% off a price that isn't actually charged to anyone. If you're using algorithmic pricing and you're telling people they're getting a discount and they're not actually getting such a discount, it's instead a personalized price tied to their demographics. That's another way you can run afoul of the law. Oh, and one more legal risk. Longer I go, the more I think about this. If you are using these third-party tools, there is a real risk that they could be facilitating collusion. The Department of Justice sued RealPage and a bunch of a large institutional landlords for using algorithmic rent setting in a way that was facilitating collusion among these landlords. That same risk exists in other industries too. So I would just urge companies to really proceed with caution if they're going to engage in personalized pricing. Certainly it can piss off. I should use less salty language. Certainly it can frustrate your customers, but it could also run afoul of a number of laws that are already on the books.
And couldn't there be one other way, which is maybe you have a national advertising campaign for a certain price point, right? But then that's not really available to, you know, to Christina or Sam, because they've decided we live in an area where they think they can charge us more, right? So I think there can be another, yet one more reason, which is if you're advertising, we provide this hotel room or this property or this product at this price, but somehow, because they've decided that you know, you or I will pay more, they'll charge us more. I think there could be another piece of it in the advertising side of when consumers find out, wait, just because I live in this neighborhood or I have this background, I'm getting charged more. Aside from potential discrimination, there could also be false advertising, maybe in connection with those. Is that a possibility as well that you can see?
It's an excellent point. You have some cities and states. I think California has a law like this that says you can't charge someone more than the price you advertise. That is a serious risk too. I really feel as I have not been a plaintiff's lawyer, but if I were, and I had a client who believes they were harmed by personalized pricing, it's a law school issue spotter. All the issues that can emerge, and again, that doesn't mean state law additional protections are not necessary, nor does it mean that personalized pricing is illegal under all circumstances. You already see it in different markets. My main point is that even as California and many other states consider bills to prohibit this practice, one should not infer from that it is otherwise legal. There are serious legal risks. You just added another one that's very important.
Excellent. No, that's a great point. So we've talked about sort of using AI and how that can go sideways. But what about AI impersonator fraud or fake review fraud? Can you talk a bit about issues you see with that coming up, where, you know, a lot of people today really rely on this product's got 5 stars, it must be great, or this company is wonderful, and in fact don't realize that maybe there's fake AI reviews behind it that sort of have substance.
Yes. Excellent. There's a lot to say about that. So first, big picture, I have serious concerns about AI turbocharging fraud. We've been worried about grandparent scams, you know, where someone calls a grandparent and says, it's Sam, I've been abducted, you need to wire $500,000 in crypto immediately, you know, et cetera, et cetera. AI is going to make those types of scams easier to scale and more effective. You can perfectly capture, you could take 3 seconds or so from the video you're watching now, feed it into one of these voice cloning tools, clone my voice, and start calling people. I'm not encouraging anyone to do this. It is illegal. Calling people and extorting them. And there are many other ways. I already mentioned how people are making a tool, you know, making false claims about how AI can make people rich. But, you know, the whole notion of artificial intelligence is it is artificial intelligence. It's all about impersonating people. So when you have year after year at the FTC impersonation fraud, the number one source of fraud complaints, and then you layer on top, and that's before the rise of AI, and then you layer on top of that a technology perfectly designed to impersonate people at scale, this is a massive, massive problem. You mentioned reviews in particular. AI has benefits here. I certainly have used AI to sort of, you know, summarize different reviews people have left. But therein lies the question that you raised. Are the reviews AI is summarizing themselves written by AI tools, or are they actual people? We brought a case, the FTC brought a case end of last year against a company called Ryter, R-Y-T-R, where we alleged the company developed a tool to generate thousands of reviews about a product. And we did not allege that the company committed fraud, but we alleged that the company provided the means and instrumentalities for others to commit fraud. And we alleged that it was an unfair practice to develop such a tool because it's hard to imagine a legitimate use of a tool to generate a bunch of reviews of a product that AI didn't, you know, try on the socks, the human did, right? Now we can talk about this. That case we brought two very strong, not I would say in their persuasiveness, but strong in their tone, dissents from Republican commissioners, one of whom is now chair. Happy to talk about that. But we allege that was unfair, and what it speaks to is the problem you're raising. That in addition to impersonation fraud, like voice cloning, you can also use AI to generate fake reviews, which is already a huge problem. The FTC tried to curb, you know, we finalized during my tenure a review prohibiting these reviews, but AI can turbocharge them. So let me just talk briefly about the strategy. And then if you're interested, we could talk about the partisan split on that case, because I think it's interesting. First, we wanted to make sure that there were strong penalties for engaging in fraud. So we finalize an impersonation rule that gives the FTC heightened remedial tools to challenge. It was already deceptive. Gives the FTC heightened remedial tools to challenge impersonation fraud. Second, we finalize a fake review rule. Same theory. Already deceptive under the FTC Act. This gives the FTC much stronger tools to deter companies from engaging in this practice by allowing the FTC to recover large civil penalties. Third, we launched a voice cloning challenge where we offered a cash award to folks. We invited people to submit technological and policy solutions to interrupt voice cloning. We got some really exciting submissions. We named the awardees at the end of last year. That generated a lot of enthusiasm both at the FTC and among academics and technology firms for leveraging American innovation to stop fraud. And the last piece of it, which brings me back to the beginning, is we really pursued an upstream enforcement strategy. We didn't just want to go after the scammers who impersonate grandma or who use voice cloning to impersonate grandma. We wanted to make sure that the companies that were deploying these extremely powerful tools were taking adequate precautions, whether that means know your customer, whether that means verification that the person's voice being cloned is actually that person. You know, we started on that path in enforcement for reasons I can get into. I am not sure that will continue at the federal level, but it is my hope that states will pick that up. And I'm happy to get into that more if that would be of interest.
I think it definitely would. I mean, I think it's important. We've obviously talked about the really important work done under your tenure and previously. But, you know, what do you see as you know, sort of taking a crystal ball out and what you've seen since you left in terms of the direction the FTC has gone or potentially may go? Again, not asking you to totally predict the future, but kind of what are you seeing since you've left and changes that are sort of on the horizon potentially?
Well, I'll start with the good news. and then I'll get to the very disconcerting news. So, you know, the good news is the CFPB has been destroyed effectively or nearly destroyed. I am heartbroken by that. It's terrible for the American economy. It's terrible for American consumers. I love the FTC. I would have spent my whole career there if I could. The FTC can't just both because of its authority, different jurisdiction, different resources. The FTC can't just pick up the slack where the of the CFPB. That's not the focus of this webinar, so I won't get into it. But that's a major problem in the consumer protection landscape generally. Thank goodness folks in California had the foresight to stand up the DFPI, your own mini CFPB in the state. Other states should probably do the same. Back to the FTC. So the FTC has not been defunded or anything like that. But the president illegally fired, in my view, two Democratic commissioners, Commissioner Bedoya, Commissioner Slaughter. They have sued. I expect that case is going to go to the Supreme Court. We can get into that if people are interested. Commissioner Bedoya, who is someone whom I really admire and respect and like as a friend. I was very sad to see just yesterday he announced he was resigning due to, his statement could speak for itself. So the FTC as of today is no longer bipartisan. You only have three Republican commissioners actually sitting on the commission. That's a major problem too.
Not to interrupt. Can you explain the way that the FTC is normally set up in terms of the five commissioners for those who may not know?
I was tempted to do that, but I didn't want to go down a rabbit hole, but I'll try to be brief.
Right.
So the FTC, so there's a myth that it has to be bipartisan. It doesn't have to be bipartisan. What the statute says is no more than three members can be of the president's party, and they can only be removed for cause. And for the whole history of the FTC, there have been moments, including during my tenure, when there have only been Democrats or only been one party at the FTC. But the norm has been for the whole 110-year history of the FTC, there's been a bipartisan commission that's part of an institutional design. And the protections for commissioners, the idea that presidents can only fire them for cause, was specifically challenged in the 1930s, and the Supreme Court upheld those protections in the famous case, famous to FTC nerds, Humphrey's executor. The president, Trump, has asserted that Humphrey's executor is not good law. He is not, in spite of the Supreme Court repeatedly reaffirming it, fired Commissioner Slaughter and Commissioner Bedoya without even an assertion of cause. They're no longer Democrats on the commission. I should say, I believe Commissioner Slaughter was illegally fired and that she therefore still is a commissioner, but in terms of actually in the job, voting on matters, she is not.
Thank you. Thanks for explaining that. That's really helpful. You talked a bit about rulemaking and kind of some of the things the FTC has done in that space. You've given some examples. Are there other examples you can talk about in terms of rulemaking that's happened, or if you anticipate changes to potential changes to rules that are currently in place in the future with the new composition of the commission?
Sure. Well, let me actually go back to enforcement since I didn't quite cover that, and then I'll turn to rulemaking. We have not seen so far in these first 6 months, feels like longer, of the administration. We have not seen what the privacy enforcement is going to look like, which is interesting to me. A couple data points. Some of the most ambitious privacy cases that the FTC brought during my tenure not only got bipartisan support, they got strong bipartisan support. And I think that's an important message for this audience. The GoodRx case, which got a ban on, didn't say, tell people you're sharing their medication information. It prohibited GoodRx from sharing medication information for advertising purposes, got strong bipartisan support. Commissioner Wilson issued a statement. We haven't talked about this yet, but we brought a series of, I think, really groundbreaking cases against data brokers for mishandling consumers' location data. Those have overwhelmingly been bipartisan, both with the Republicans who were on the commission early in the Biden administration and with Republicans still in the commission today. There is some nuance there. There were different counts in different cases that they dissented on, but read their statements. I believe that there is a consensus among commissioners that data brokers' practice of freely sharing and selling sensitive geolocation data can be unfair under the FTC Act. I believe that every commissioner has said as much. Children's privacy, you've seen even more bipartisan support. The Epic Games case, we have not talked about yet, the largest children's privacy case we ever brought, challenged the company's default settings as being unfair under the FTC Act. Recovered more than $500 million in the monetary relief, got strong bipartisan support. We had the case I mentioned over the summer with the LA District Attorney against this major app, NGL, which banned the company from marketing its services to kids or teens, also got Bipartisan support. So you see a lot of bipartisan support for even some of the more far-reaching privacy, especially kids' privacy cases. This year, under the new administration, we saw the administration, you know, we were planning to hold a workshop on the attention economy and how tech companies were using design techniques to try to keep people hooked, potentially harming kids. The new administration did not abandon that. They changed the nature of it quite a bit, made it very focused on big tech and harms from big tech. But they went forward with that workshop. And if you read some of the speeches that the Republican commissioner said, they said that big tech privacy practices and practices around addiction and children were very concerning to them. So I don't exactly know what to make of this new administration. I think they supported many of the most ambitious privacy cases in the over the last 4 years. I think they'll continue to be aggressive on kids, including on our new children's privacy rule, which was unanimously supported. That was finalized beginning of this year. I don't know where they will be on data brokers or some of these other issues. We just have not seen any enforcement yet.
Right.
And by the way, that itself is concerning. The fact that we are coming on 6 months into this administration, and I could be mistaken, but I don't think they have filed a single privacy case. I personally don't like the signal that that sends, but I would not assume that they're not going to bring in privacy cases in the future. There's, as you know, Christy, there's always a ramp up with the new administration while they're vetting the investigations already underway and deciding whether it comports with their own approach to the law.
Right. Right. No, that's really helpful.
Oh, rulemaking.
Yeah.
Should I?
Go back to that.
Yeah, they're not going to do. So I won't get into the long FTC history of rulemaking, though I think it's interesting. On privacy rulemaking in particular, the big thing we did not do that I wish we could have done, that I think we would have done if we had had more time, was a comprehensive privacy rule under the FTC Act. We solicited comments. I can't get into non-public information about work that was done or that was not done, but it is a real regret of mine that we were not able to issue a rule. I think a rule, some baseline privacy protections are long overdue, even with because many states don't have any privacy laws, let alone privacy laws as strong as California's. I think the chance of this administration moving forward with the privacy rule, given, I mean, you have an executive order that says for every rule promulgated, you need to repeal 10. I don't think you you don't have 10 rules at, I mean, you barely have 10 rules at the FTC, as you know, to repeal. So I don't think there's any chance this administration moves forward with a new privacy rule. But there was privacy rulemaking that we did that I think will survive. Graham Leach Bliley, we significantly updated the safeguards rule, which has to do with data security standards for non-bank financial institutions. We significantly updated Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Got unanimous support for changes we made, especially around making it easier for parents to opt out of targeted advertising, prohibiting indefinite retention, and more. And we updated significantly our health breach notification rule, which we haven't talked about yet, but I think is really important for companies that are operating apps or other services that collect sensitive health information. If it's being shared without consumers' authorization, that can be a breach under the health breach notification, even if it wasn't stolen, even if it was just shared without consumer authorization. That can be considered a breach under the health breach notification rule, and companies can be sued and face civil penalties for not reporting that breach to consumers and to the FTC. That's another rule that we updated that so far has not been touched. So I think there has, plus, as I mentioned, the impersonation rule, the fake review rule, which are going to be critical tools to combat fraud. But the administration has already been enforcing both rules. The junk fee rule, which I talked about surveillance pricing earlier, the junk fee rule requires all-in pricing. The administration has already indicated they're going to be enforcing that rule. So I think with the rules we did, we're seeing continuity, which is really great to see. But you're not going to see, I don't think, any new rules promulgated under this administration,
right?
At least on privacy.
Right. No, that's helpful. You talked a little bit about the healthcare privacy rules, and I know there have been a number of cases the FTC's brought in the healthcare space around privacy. Can you talk a bit about that, and you know what people should know and understand if they're working in the healthcare space and dealing with private information, and what they might want to think about in that context?
So when the Dobbs decision came down in 2022, I think that was a wake-up call for a lot of Americans about privacy not being an abstraction. That, oh, you mean the government can actually go to a data broker and purchase information on all my whereabouts all the time, what church I'm going to, what doctor I'm going to, what school I'm going to, where I'm spending my days, when I'm crossing state lines. But it was not new to the FTC. As you know, Christina, this is something we had been sounding the alarm about for years, that especially the surreptitious collection of sense, you know, when people down, I know all the lawyers on this crowd know this, when you download an app and it's free, you're the product, right? Your location is being your information is likely being harvested by that app and sold. So there's this vast underground market for people's sensitive geolocation data that can reveal information, since you asked about, it can reveal all sorts of things. But among other things, it can reveal information about people's healthcare, what healthcare they're seeking. Similarly, and the FTC, as I alluded to, took a very aggressive approach to that. We sued data broker after data broker, alleging that they needed to start filtering out sensitive data, data that reveals, for example, people's visits to reproductive health centers, and not straight out prohibition on onward sale or sharing of that data. So that was one way we tried to protect health privacy. Another way was we went after health data directly. So I had been talking about location data that can reveal people's health. We also brought cases like Premom, Cerebral, GoodRx, BetterHelp. These were all cases where companies collected people's sensitive health information, what m mental health treatments they were seeking, what prescriptions they were taking, whether they were looking to have a child. And sharing that information with different social media companies so that advertisers could target their users. We alleged in some cases that this violated the health breach notification rule I mentioned earlier. We alleged in all cases that these practices were unfair under the FTC Act. And my strong advice to companies that collect sensitive health information, whether you agree with me that it's unfair or not, if consumers find out about it, and we know that this happened, they're going to be really upset. I really believe it is a breach of trust. If you really want to share someone's sensitive health information, you should be at a minimum getting affirmative express consent, and that means consumers can opt in, and if they don't want to share it, they shouldn't have to share it. I think this is really visceral for people. I don't think it's a partisan issue. I don't think people want to have what medication they're taking. They don't want that information being sold. So we took a multifaceted approach to health privacy rulemaking, enforcement, guidance, but there's still a lot of work to do, and I certainly hope this administration picks up the picks it up.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. We do have a couple of questions that have come in, so maybe we'll ask those before we run out of
Sure.
time. But we have a question about, we talked about surveillance pricing, where someone might
Oh,
have
yeah.
a higher price. Someone asked about surveillance discounts. Is that the same analysis a company should do if they decide that, you know, Sam likes to hover over this page, you know, 15 times, and so maybe we're going to give him a discount, so he decides to put it in his basket. And so there's a question about whether that surveillance discounting may have some similar implications or things to be concerned about.
I think it depends. Questions I would ask include, is this a discount available to all consumers? You know, is this a fast food chain saying, you know, discount on fries from 11 to 12 o'clock? Or is this a discount to individual consumers based on data that that app was collecting about them? I would ask, is it an actual discount? If I'm giving you, Christina, a 20% discount, and I'm giving everyone else a discounted price, 30%, 10%, 40%, but no one's actually paying the reference price, the real price. It's long-standing FTC law, and I think law in just about every state, that that is a deceptive practice. So I think it really depends on the circumstance. I saw that the same person asked about Uber surge pricing. I don't want to get into it, how Uber's algorithm works. That would be a question for Uber. The question was, is Uber surge pricing not personalized pricing? I think it can be personalized pricing. And again, if consumer, if you're a company and you want to start engaging in this type of practice, go out and ask your customers whether they like Uber surge pricing. Go out and ask your customers whether they like booking a flight at the last minute. Setting aside the legal risk here, I think there are real there's it's a real source of consumer frustration by me as well.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about the FTC and partnerships? I know you talked about working with the DA, but maybe for the audience to have an understanding about circumstances and instances where the FTC may choose to partner with a state or a local agency, and how that might benefit consumers in terms of that kind of a practice.
So I'm an alum of an AG's office. I love state work. I love municipal work too. States are on the front lines. They have the best sense of what the challenges are consumers are facing in their jurisdictions. One of my priorities as director was strengthening partnerships with states. We issued a report on how we were trying to do that. Our regional offices, including one in LA and one in San Francisco, are really on the front lines of that. Christina's an alum. But as Christina also knows, state federal collaboration certainly did not begin with my tenure. It's actually how the two of us met was some years ago on a case Christina was working on at the FTC, and I had some knowledge of in state government. FTC partners with states all the time. That became more urgent in 2021 when the Supreme Court handed down a decision called AMG that basically stopped the FTC from getting refunds for people in federal court unless a rule was violated. So in other words, if you engage in unfair deceptive practices, the California DOJ could go into court and get money back to victims. FTC could not go into federal court and get money back to victims unless a specific rule had been violated. So because of that ruling, the need and the importance of partnering with states only grew. And one of the things we started doing in my tenure was partnering, we had always partnered with states on fraud and other areas. We really started partnering with states on more tech cases, including, I mentioned, with the LA District Attorney. We brought CRI Genetics with California. We really tried to strengthen our relationship both with state AGs and with state privacy enforcers to make sure, A, that we were maximizing the remedies we could recover in court, make sure we could make consumers whole. But B, I think we really benefited from hearing from states about what the biggest issues their consumers were facing and how could we as federal enforcers support their work.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I think having also come from a state AG's office before, I think those partnerships are really important, and being able to address some of the AMG issues, but also being able to have those partnerships where state and local agencies can be part of it and really work to help protect their consumers as well, using their consumer protection laws, which often have penalties and pretty significant restitution pieces to them, I think are really another important tool. And I think it's great that the FTC's look to pivot. And I think that's one of the messages that you've had here today, is sort of the importance of the FTC looking at the landscape and pivoting, whether it's through rulemaking or whether it's through using different parts of Section 5 of the FTC Act or partnerships as a way to just meet the ultimate goal of sort of helping consumers be protected and be in a fair marketplace, right, where they can get sort of the best results. So I think that's really important, and hats off to you for all of your great work while you were there, Sam. I mean, really important cases came out during your during your tenure. We're getting close to the end, so I'll put it back to you to see if you have any closing thoughts or anything you want to add to sort of the audience to consider in this privacy AI space as we get to the last few minutes.
So I don't need to tell Californians, especially those of you in the LA area, that the November election led to a very dramatic change in power in Washington, D.C. But for those of you who practice in the privacy AI space, I would not assume, I strongly would urge you not to assume that we're just going to go back to 2016 or 2020 in terms of how the FTC views its mandate on privacy and AI. There were strong disagreements among the FTC commissioners about certain cases, but the Overton window has shifted. I really believe that very fundamentally. You now have bipartisan consensus with strong support in Congress that data brokers are mishandling our sensitive geolocation data, and that that can be under unfair to the FTC Act, that health apps need to use far more caution in handling their sensitive health data, and that can be actionable under health breach notification rule or be unfair under the FTC Act. You have a sea change in kids protections, where this growing state, not only growing state interest in enforcing children's privacy laws, but strong bipartisan consensus at the FTC, both for expanding and strengthening the FTC's children's privacy rule and enforcing that rule aggressively. And you've heard that rhetoric very consistently. So, in spite of the dramatic change we've seen in Washington generally, I think when it comes to basic FTC compliance issues, you are not going to see a 180. You'll see changes, to be sure, but we're not just going to go back to the notice and choice era of the past. We are in a new world, I think, where companies need to be thinking about not just whether they disclose what they're doing with people's data or how they're using AI tools. They need to be thinking about, are our collection practices, are our sharing practices, are our AI tools harming people? And if they are, that should raise concerns whether we're engaging in an unfair practice under the FTC Act. That would be my, I think, most important message for people trying to stay on the right side of the law, which I
Fantastic.
know is all of you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sam. I could I this was really enlightening, and we really appreciate your contributions to the Beverly Hills Bar. With that, I think we'll close out the session. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining.
Thank you for joining, and thanks for having me. It's been great to be here.